tired and anxious. Marjorie made him a light supper, and they went to bed and made love. In the morning he told her about his trip. She was shocked, rigid, by what he said, and struggled to hide her emotions. Fortunately, he was in a hurry to report to Robert Cecil, and he went out immediately after breakfast, leaving her free to think in peace. There was a plan to kill the royal family, all except Princess Elizabeth, and at the same time all the leading ministers, which probably meant burning down a palace, Ned had said. But Marjorie knew more. Bartlett was going to miss the opening of Parliament for the first time since he had become Earl of Shiring. Marjorie had been puzzled by his decision, but now it made sense. The plotters would strike at Westminster. The opening ceremony was 10 days away. How did Bartlett know about it? Ned had learned that Jean Langlais was involved, and Marjorie knew that Langlais was Rollo. Bartlett's uncle Rollo had warned him to stay away. She knew it all now. But what was she to do? She could denounce Rollo to Ned, and perhaps that was what she would have to do in the end, although she shuddered with horror at the thought of sending her brother to his death. However, there might be a better way. She could go and see Rollo. She knew where he was lodging. She could tell him she knew everything and threatened to reveal all to Ned. Once Ned knew, the entire plot was doomed. Rollo would have no choice but to give the whole thing up. She put on a heavy cloak and stout boots and went out into the London autumn. She walked to the White Swan and found the red-nosed landlord.
"Good day to you, Mr. Hodgkinson," she said. "I was here a few weeks ago."
The landlord was grumpy, perhaps because he had drunk too much of his own wine the night before. He gave her a look of indifference and said, "I can't remember everyone who buys a cup of wine in here."
"No matter. I want to see Rollo Fitzgerald."
"There's no one of that name in the house," he said tersely.
"But he was lodging here."
He gave her a hostile look.
"May I ask who you are?"
Marjorie assumed an air of aristocratic hauteur.
"I am the Dowager Countess of Shiring, and you would do well to mind your manners."
He changed his tune. No one wanted to quarrel with an aristocrat.
"I beg your pardon, my lady, but I can't recall ever having a guest of the name you mentioned."
"I wonder if any of his friends stayed here. What about Jean Langlais?"
"Oh, yes," said Hodgkinson. "French name, though he spoke like an Englishman. But he left."
"Do you know where he went?"
"No. Monsieur Langlais is not a man to give out unnecessary information, my lady. Close-mouthed, he is."
Of course he was. She left the inn. What was she going to do now? She had no idea where Rollo might be. There was now little point in denouncing him to Ned, for Ned would not be able to find him either. She racked her brains. People were going to commit an atrocity, and she had to stop them. Could she give warning? Perhaps she could do that without condemning Rollo to death. She considered an anonymous letter. She could write to Ned, disguising her handwriting, and pretend to be one of the conspirators. She need not say anything about Rollo. The letter would simply warn Ned to stay away from the opening of Parliament if he wanted to live. But that was implausible. Why would a Catholic conspirator want to save the life of a famous Protestant courtier? On the other hand, if the letter went to a Catholic, he might approve of the plot and keep the news to himself. What she needed was someone in between, a man who was loyal to the king, but sufficiently friendly to Catholics that they would not want to kill him. There were several such people at court, and Marjorie thought of Lord Monteagle, a Catholic who wanted to be at peace with his Protestant countrymen. People such as Rollo and Bartlett spoke of him as a weak ditherer, but Marjorie thought he was sensible. If he were warned, he would sound the alarm. She decided to write him a letter. She stepped out to one of the many stationery shops in St. Paul's Churchyard and bought some paper of a type she did not normally use. Back in the house, she sharpened a quill with a penknife. Using her left hand to disguise her writing, she began, "My lord, out of the love I bear to some of your friends, I have a care of your preservation." That was nicely vague, she thought. "Therefore, I would advise you, as you tender your life, to devise some excuse to shift off your attendance at this Parliament." That was unmistakable. His life was in danger. What would Rollo say in such a message? Something pious, perhaps. "For God and man have concurred to punish the wickedness of this time.
That seemed to have the right apocalyptic tone. And think not slightly of this advertisement, but retire yourself into your country, where you may expect the event in safety. She needed to say something about the means by which the killing would be done, but all she knew was that Ned thought they planned to set the building on fire. She should hint at something like that. For though there be no appearance of any stir, yet I say they shall receive a terrible blow this Parliament, and yet they shall not see who hurts them. What else would a conspirator think about? Destroying the evidence? This council is not to be condemned because it may do you good, and can do you no harm, for the danger is past as soon as you have burned the letter. And how should she end? With something sincere, she decided. And I hope God will give you the grace to make good use of it, to whose holy protection I commend you. She folded the letter and sealed it, pressing a coin into the soft wax and wiggling it a bit to make the impression unreadable, as if a seal ring had been carelessly applied. Now she had to deliver it. She would probably be seen by people at the house, and perhaps by Monteagle himself, who knew her, so she needed a disguise. Marjorie and Ned employed a maid-of-all-work, who was at present washing sheets in the backyard. Marjorie told her to take the rest of the day off, and gave her sixpence to go to the bear-baiting. She went to Ned's wardrobe. She put on a pair of his breeches, tucking her petticoats inside for bulk, and then a frayed old doublet. Ned was slim, but nevertheless, his clothes were too big for her. However, a mere messenger would be expected to be badly dressed. She put on a worn-down pair of his shoes and stuffed them with rags to make them fit. Her ankles were too small for a man, she saw. She pinned up her hair and put on Ned's third-best hat. It would be awkward if Ned were to come home now, but he would almost certainly be out all day. Work would have piled up on his table while he was in Paris, and he was supposed to have dinner at Cecil's house. The likelihood of a surprise return was low, she hoped. In the mirror she did not look much like a man. She was too pretty, and her hands were too small. She put a coal shovel up the chimney and brought down a quantity of soot, then used it to besmirch her hands and face. That was better, the mirror told her. Now she could pass for a grubby little old man of the kind who might well be used as a messenger. She left the house by the back door and hurried away, hoping that any neighbours who glimpsed her would not recognise her. She went east to Aldgate, and passed out of the city. She walked through fields to the village of Hoxton, where Monteagle had a suburban house in a large garden. She went to the back door, as a scruffy messenger would. A man with his mouth full of food came to the door. She handed the letter to him and said, in her gruffest voice, "For Lord Monteagle, personal and very important." The man chewed and swallowed.
"And who is it from?"
"A gentleman that gave me a penny."
"All right, old boy, here's another."
She held out her hand, small but dirty, and took the coin. Then she turned away. Ned Willard and most of the Privy Council were sitting around Robert Cecil's dining table when a servant came in to tell Cecil that Lord Monteagle needed to speak to him very urgently. Cecil excused himself and asked Ned to go with him. Monteagle was waiting in a side room, looking anxious, holding a sheet of paper as if it might explode. He began with what was obviously a prepared sentence. "The writer of this letter appears to think me a traitor," he said, "but I hope to prove I am not by bringing the letter to you, the Secretary of State, within an hour of having received it." It struck Ned as ironic that the tall, strapping young Lord Monteagle was so visibly frightened of the dwarfish Cecil.
"Your loyalty isn't in doubt," Cecil murmured pacifically.
That was not quite true, Ned thought, but Cecil was being polite. Monteagle proffered the letter, and Cecil took it, his high, white forehead creased in a frown as he began to read.
"By the mass, this is untidy handwriting."
He read to the end, then passed it to Ned. Cecil's hands were long and fine-boned, like those of a tall woman. Cecil asked Monteagle,
"How did this come to you?"
"My manservant brought it to me at supper. It was given him by a man who came to the kitchen door. My man gave the messenger a penny."
"After you read the letter, did you send someone to fetch the messenger back?"
"Of course. But he'd disappeared. Frankly, I suspect my servant may have finished his supper before bringing the letter to me, though he swore otherwise. At all events, we couldn't find the messenger when we looked for him, so I saddled my horse and came straight here.
You did the right thing, my lord.
Thank you.
What do you think of it, Ned? The whole thing is plainly some kind of fake, said Ned. Monteagle was surprised.
Really?
Look, the writer cares for your preservation, he says, out of the love he bears some of your friends. It seems a bit unlikely.
Why?
The letter is proof of treason. If a man knows of a plot to kill the king, his duty is to tell the Privy Council, and if he does not do so, he may hang for it. Would a man endanger his own life for the sake of a friend of a friend?
Monteagle was bewildered. I never thought of that, he said. I took the letter at face value.
Cecil smiled knowingly. Sir Ned never takes anything at face value, he said.
In fact, Ned went on, I suspect the writer is very well known to you, or at least to someone to whom you might show the letter.
Once again Monteagle looked out of his depth.
Why do you say that?
No one writes like this except a schoolboy who has not yet gained full control of his pen, yet the phrasing is that of an adult. Therefore, the writing is deliberately disguised.
That suggests that someone who is likely to read the letter knows the sender well enough to recognize his hand.
How dreadful, said Monteagle. I wonder who it can be.
The sentence about the wickedness of the time is mere padding, Ned went on, thinking aloud. The meat of the message is in the next sentence. If Monteagle attends Parliament, he may be killed. That part, I suspect, is true. It fits with what I learned in Paris.
Cecil said, But how is the killing to be done?
Key question. I believe the writer doesn't know. Look at the vagueness. They shall receive a terrible blow. They shall not see who hurts them. It suggests danger from a distance, perhaps by cannon fire, but nothing more specific.
Cecil nodded. Or, of course, the whole thing could be a figment of a madman's imagination.
Ned said, I don't think so.
Cecil shrugged. There's no concrete evidence and nothing we can check. An anonymous letter is just a piece of paper.
Cecil was right. The evidence was flimsy. But Ned's instinct told him the threat was real. Anxiously, he said, Whatever we think, the letter must be shown to the king.
Of course, said Cecil. He's hunting in Hertfordshire, but this will be the first thing he sees when he returns to London.
Marjorie had always known this terrible day would come. She had managed to forget the fact, even for years at a time, and she had been happy. But in her heart, she had realized there would be a reckoning. She had deceived Ned for decades, but a lie always came back to you sooner or later, and now that time had come.
I know that Jean Langlais means to kill the king, Ned said to her, worried and frustrated, but I can't do anything about it because I don't know who Langlais is or where to find him.
Marjorie felt crucified by guilt. She had known that the elusive man Ned had been hunting most of his life was Rollo, and she had kept this knowledge to herself. But now it seemed Rollo was going to kill the king and queen and their two sons, plus all the leading ministers, including Ned himself. She could not allow that to happen. Yet still she was not sure what to do, for even if she revealed the secret, it might not save anyone. She knew who Langlais was, but not where he was, and she had no idea how he planned to kill everyone. She and Ned were at home in St. Paul's Churchyard. They had eaten a breakfast of hen's eggs with weak beer, and Ned had his hat on, about to leave for Robert Cecil's house. At this moment in the day, he often lingered, standing by the fire, to share his worries with her. Now he said, Langlais has been very, very careful. Always. Marjorie knew that was true. The secret priests she had helped Rollo smuggle into England had known him as Langlais, and none of them had been told she was his sister. The same went for all the people he conspired with to free Mary Stuart and make her queen. They all knew him as Langlais, none as Rollo Fitzgerald. In being so cautious, he was unlike most of his co-conspirators. They had approached their mission in a daredevil spirit, but Rollo had known the quality of the people he was up against, especially of Ned, and he had never taken unnecessary risks. Marjorie said to Ned, Can't you cancel the opening of Parliament?
No,
We might postpone it, or move it to a different location, though that would look bad enough. James's enemies would say the king is so hated by the people that he's afraid to open his own parliament in case he might be assassinated. So James will make the decision himself. But the ceremony has to take place sometime, somewhere. The country must be governed. Marjorie could bear it no longer. She said, "Ned, I did a terrible thing." At first he was not sure how to take this.
"What?"
"I didn't lie to you, but I kept a secret from you. I thought I had to. I still think I had to. But you will be terribly angry."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"I know who Jean Longley is." Ned was uncharacteristically bewildered.
"What? How could you? But who is it?"
"It's Rollo." Ned looked as if he had been told someone had died. He went pale, and his mouth dropped open. He staggered and sat down heavily. At last he said,
"And you knew?"
Marjorie could not speak. She felt as if she were being strangled. She realized that tears were streaming down her cheeks. She nodded.
"How long?"
She gasped, sobbed, and managed to say,
"Always? But how could you keep this from me?"
When at last she found words, they came fast. "I thought he was just smuggling harmless priests into England to bring the sacraments to Catholics. Then you found out he was conspiring to free Mary Stuart and Queen Elizabeth, and he left the country. And he came back after the Spanish Armada, but he said it was all over, and he wouldn't conspire any more, and if I betrayed him, he would reveal that Bartlett and Roger had helped smuggle priests."
"You wrote the letter to Monteagle?"
She nodded. "I wanted to warn you without condemning Rollo."
"How did you find out?"
"Bartlett told me he's not coming to the opening of Parliament. He's never missed it before. Rollo must have warned him."
"All this going on, and I didn't know. Me, the master spy, deceived by his own wife."
"Oh, Ned."
Ned looked at her as if she were the vilest criminal. "And Rollo was in Kingsbridge the day Sylvie died."
His words were like a bullet, and she found she could no longer stand. She sank to her knees on the rug. "You want to kill me? I can tell," she said. "Go ahead, do it. I can't live now."
"I was so angry when people said I could no longer be trusted to work for Queen Elizabeth because I had married a Catholic. What fools they were, I thought. Now it turns out that I was the fool."
"No, you weren't."
He gave her a look so full of rage that it broke her heart.
"Oh, yes, I was,"
he said, and then he went out. Ned and Cecil saw King James on the first day of November. He received them at Whitehall, in the long gallery, which ran from the private rooms to the orchard. As well as paintings, the gallery featured priceless draperies in gold and silver brocade, just the kind of thing James liked. Ned knew that Cecil doubted the authenticity of the Monteagle letter, suspecting it might be no more than a piece of troublemaking. Cecil continued to believe this even when Ned told him that Earl Bartlett, a Catholic peer, was planning to miss the opening of Parliament for no plausible reason, and had probably been warned off. Cecil's plan was to take all possible precautions, but not to reschedule the ceremony. Ned had a different agenda. Ned wanted to do more than prevent the planned murders. Too often he had been on the trail of traitors, only to see them scared off, after which they lived to plot another day. This time he wanted to arrest the conspirators. He wanted, finally, to get Rollo. Cecil gave the Monteagle letter to James, saying, "One would, of course, never keep something such as this from your Majesty. On the other hand, it may not merit being taken seriously. It isn't backed by any facts." Ned added, "No facts, your Majesty, but there are supporting indications. I heard rumours in Paris." James shrugged.
"Rumours," he said.
Ned said, "You can't believe them and you can't ignore them."
"Exactly."
James read the letter, holding it up to the lamp, for the winter light coming through the windows was weak. He took his time and Ned's thoughts strayed to Marjorie. He had not seen her since her revelation. He was sleeping at a tavern. He could not bear the thought of seeing her or speaking to her. It was too painful. He could not even identify the emotion that swamped him, whether rage or hatred or grief. All he could do was look away and engage his mind with something else. The king let the beringed hand holding the letter drop to his side, and he stood still for a minute or so, looking nowhere. Ned saw intelligence in his eyes, and a determined line to his mouth, but a streak of self-indulgence was evidenced by his blemished skin and puffy eyes. It was hard, Ned guessed, to be disciplined and moderate when you possessed absolute power. The king read the letter again, then said to Cecil, "What do you think?" "We could reinforce Westminster Yard with guards and cannons immediately. Then we could close the gates and search the precincts thoroughly. After that, we could control and monitor everyone entering and leaving until the opening of Parliament is safely passed." This was Cecil's preferred plan, but both he and Ned knew they had to give the king options, not instructions. James was always conscious of his public image, for all his talk of the divine right of kings. "We must take care not to alarm the public over what might be nothing at all," he said. "It makes the king look weak and frightened. Your Majesty's safety is paramount, but Sir Ned has an alternative suggestion." James looked inquiringly at Ned. Ned was ready. "Consider this, Your Majesty. If there is a plot, then perhaps the preparations are not yet complete. So, if we act now, we may fail to find what we're looking for. Worse, we may find incomplete preparations, which would give us only questionable evidence at a trial. Then the Catholic pamphleteers would say the charges were trumped up as a pretext for persecution." James did not yet get the point.
"We have to do something."
"Indeed. In order to catch all the plotters and seize the maximum amount of incriminating evidence, we need to pounce at the last minute. That will protect Your Majesty both immediately and, importantly, in the future as well." Ned held his breath. This was the crucial point. James looked at Cecil.
"I think he may be right."
"It's for Your Majesty to judge." The king turned back to Ned.
"Very well. Act on the 4th of November."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," Ned said with relief. Ned and Cecil backed away, bowing. Then the king was struck by an afterthought and said,
"Do we have any idea who is behind this wickedness?"
All Ned's frenzy at Margery came back to him in a tidal wave, and he struggled to suppress the shaking of his body.
"Yes, Your Majesty,"
he said in a voice that was barely controlled. "It's a man called Rollo Fitzgerald from Shirin. I'm ashamed to tell you that he's my brother-in-law."
"In that kiss," said James with more than a hint of menace, "by God's blood, you'd better catch the swain."
Chapter 30. When the plotters heard about the Monteagle letter on Sunday, November 3rd, they started to accuse one another of treachery. The atmosphere became poisonous in the wardrobe keeper's apartment.
"One of us did this," Guy Fawkes said belligerently.
Rollo feared that these aggressive young men would start fighting.
"Never mind who did it," he said hastily. "The man was certainly a fool rather than a traitor."
"How can you be sure?"
"Because a traitor would have named us all. This idiot just wanted to warn Monteagle off."
Fawkes calmed down.
"I suppose that makes sense. The important question is how much damage has been done."
"Exactly," said Thomas Percy. "Can we now go on with this plan, or should we abandon it?"
"After all we've done?"
"No."
"But if Cecil and Willard know..." "I hear the letter was vague as to details, and Cecil isn't sure what to do about it," Rollo said. "There's still a strong chance for us. We can't give up so easily. Success is within our grasp."
"How can we check?"
"You could check," Rollo said to Percy. "Tomorrow morning, I want you to go on a scouting expedition. Visit your relative, the Earl of Northumberland. Think of some pretext. Ask him for a loan, perhaps."
"What's the point?"
"It's just a cover story, so that he won't guess that you're really trying to find out how much the Privy Council knows."
"And how will I learn that?"
"By his attitude to you. If you're suspected of treachery, the Earl will almost certainly have heard a rumour by now. He'll be nervous in your presence and eager to get you out of the house as fast as possible. He might even give you the loan just to be rid of you." Percy shrugged.
All right. The group split up, leaving Fawkes in charge of the apartment. Next morning, Percy went off to see Northumberland. On his return, Rollo met him in a tavern near Bishopsgate. Percy looked cheerful. "I found him at Sion Place," he said. Rollo knew that was the Earl's country house not far west of London. "He refused point-blank to give me a loan, told me I was a scapegrace, and invited me to dinner. He has no suspicion, then. Either that, or he's a better actor than Richard Burbage. Well done. It's not really conclusive. It's strongly suggestive, though. I'll go and give Fawkes the good news." Rollo headed across London. He did not feel safe. Far from it. Ned Willard was coming too close for that. However, the stag was still ahead of the deerhounds, just. And he needed to stay ahead only a little longer, a few hours. By this time tomorrow it would be done. But when he came within sight of the House of Lords, he suffered a nasty shock. At the rear of the building, where the storeroom entrance was, several well-dressed men were emerging from the upstairs debating chamber via the back door and coming down the wooden exterior staircase. Rollo could not recall ever having seen that door used. He recognized the man leading the party. It was the Earl of Suffolk, who, as Lord Chamberlain, had to make arrangements for the opening of Parliament. With him was Lord Monteagle. Rollo cursed. This was bad. He stepped back around a corner out of sight. He fought down an urge to flee. He had to find out exactly what was going on. Whatever these men were doing was a terrible danger to his plan. He watched, half-concealed, ready at any moment to run for his life. They came down the steps and went to the double doors of the storeroom where the gunpowder was hidden. They were silent and alert, Rollo noted. Suffolk tried the door and found it locked. After some discussion, he ordered a servant to break it open. So, Rollo thought with a sinking heart, this is a search party. It was maddening. Surely his plan would not be frustrated this easily. Suffolk's servant deployed a crowbar. Rollo had not reinforced the door. The place was a storeroom, not a treasury, and the installation of iron bars or elaborate locks would have attracted attention. So the door came open with no great difficulty. The group went inside. Rollo hurried to the wardrobe keeper's apartment and ran through to the new passage Fawkes had created. He silently opened the door to the storeroom and looked in. The room was dim, as ever, and the lanterns of Suffolk's search party lit the large space only feebly. However, they had seen Guy Fawkes. "God save us," Rollo prayed silently, "or we're done for." Fawkes was standing to one side, dressed in a cloak and a tall hat, carrying a lantern. It seemed Suffolk had only just spotted him, for Rollo heard the Earl say in a startled voice, "Who are you, man?" Rollo held his breath. "I am John Johnson, my lord," said Fawkes. His voice was calm. He was a soldier, and had been in danger before. Rollo wished he had not picked a name that sounded so obviously made up. "And what the devil are you doing here, Johnson?" "My master is tenant of this store and of the apartment next door. I act as caretaker, you might say, when my master isn't here." It was a perfectly sensible story, Rollo thought, hopefully. Was there any reason why Suffolk should not accept it? "And for what purpose does your master use this vault? To store firewood, as you can see." The members of the group looked at the firewood stack as if they had not previously noticed it, which was possible in the dim light. Suffolk said, "All this wood? Just for an apartment?" Fawkes did not respond to this rhetorical question. Rollo realized with dismay that he had overlooked this implausibility. Suffolk said, "Who is your master, anyway?" "Thomas Percy." There was a little murmur of reaction from the search party. They would know Percy as a gentleman pensioner, and they would also know that he had Catholic relatives. Rollo was so filled with dread that he felt nauseous. This was the moment of greatest danger. Would anyone think to look inside a pile of firewood? He remembered saying glibly, "Even if someone were to search this place, they probably wouldn't find the gunpowder." He was about to find out whether that was true. He felt tense enough to snap. Suffolk took Monteagle aside, and the two men came closer to where Rollo stood behind the half-open door. He heard Monteagle say agitatedly, "This involves the Earl of Northumberland." "Keep your voice down," Suffolk said more calmly.
We can't accuse one of the greatest peers of the realm on the basis of an oversupply of firewood. We must do something. We must do nothing except inform the Privy Council of what we have seen.
Rollo deduced that Suffolk had not thought of combing through the woodpile. Yet.
Monteagle was calming down.
Yes. Of course. You're right. Forgive me. I fear that all this is going to be blamed on me just because I was sent an anonymous letter.
Rollo dared to hope that Monteagle's distress had distracted Suffolk from the search.
Suffolk patted Monteagle's shoulder.
I understand. The two men rejoined the group.
There was some desultory conversation, and then the search party left the building.
Fawkes closed the broken door as best he could.
Rollo stepped into the storeroom.
I heard everything, he said to Fawkes. I was behind the door.
Fawkes looked at him.
Jesus save us,
he said. That was a close call.
Marjorie was living in a pit of misery. The bottom had dropped out of her world. After Ned left, she drank little and ate nothing for a week. She saw no point in getting out of bed in the morning. If she forced herself up, she just sat by the fireside, weeping, until it got dark outside, and she could go back to bed again. Her life was over. She could have gone to her son Roger's house, but then she would have had to explain, and she could not face that. But 2 days before the opening of Parliament, she was seized by anxiety. Had Ned caught Rollo or not? Would the ceremony go ahead? Would Ned be there? Would they all die? She put on a coat and walked along the Strand to Whitehall. She did not go into the palace, but stood outside, half hidden by the gloom of a November afternoon, watching for her husband. Courtiers came and went in their fur hats. Marjorie felt faint with hunger, and had to lean on a wall to stay upright. A cold mist came up from the river, but she was already so dejected that she hardly cared. She wished with all her heart that she had not kept Rollo's secret so long. She should have told Ned the truth years ago. It would have been an earthquake whenever she did it, but this was the worst time, after he had become so much a part of her that she could not manage life without him. At last she saw him. He arrived with a small group of men in heavy coats, privy councillors, perhaps. His expression was grim. Perhaps it was an illusion, but he seemed to have aged in a week, his face creased with worry lines, grey stubble on pale cheeks. She stepped in front of him and he stopped. She watched his face, reading his feelings. He was at first just startled. Then his expression changed and he looked angry. Instinct told her that he had been trying to forget about her and what she had done, and now he disliked being reminded. Was there any sign of softening, any hint of mercy? She was not sure. She spoke the question she had come to ask.
Have you found Rollo?
No, said Ned, and he brushed past her and went inside. Sadness engulfed her. She loved him so much. She drifted away from the gates of the palace. In a daze of grief, she wandered down to the muddy beach of the Thames. The river was tidal, and right now there was a fast downstream current, making the surface restless and troubled. She thought about walking out into the water. It was almost dark now, and probably no one would see her. She had never learned to swim. Her life would end in a few minutes. It would be cold, and there would be a long moment of gasping panic, but then her agony would be over. It was a sin, a mortal sin, but hell could not be worse than this. She thought of a play she had seen in which a girl drowned herself after being rejected by the Prince of Denmark, and a pair of comic gravediggers discussed whether she should have a Christian burial. There would be no burial for Marjorie if she went into the river now. Her body would be swept away by this strong current, perhaps all the way to the sea, where she would float gently down to the deep bottom, to lie with the sailors killed in the Battle of the Spanish Armada. And who would say Mass for her soul? Protestants did not believe in prayers for the dead, and Catholics would not pray for a suicide. She would be damned as well as dead. She stood there for a long moment, pulled painfully in opposite directions by her yearning for the peace of death and her horror of incurring God's eternal wrath. At last she seemed to see her great aunt, Sister Joan, coming toward her across the mud, not as she had been in life, but walking upright, without the aid of sticks. Although it was dark,
Marjorie could see Joan's face, which was younger and smiling. The vision did not speak, but silently took Marjorie's arm and led her gently away from the water. As they approached Whitehall, Marjorie saw two young men walking along together, laughing raucously at something, and she turned to ask Joan whether they too could see her, but Joan had gone, and Marjorie was alone again. In the afternoon of Monday, November 4th, Rollo sat with Guy Fawkes on the floor in the middle of the storeroom and gave Fawkes his final instructions. Rollo produced a long match made of touchwood, dried rotted wood that was highly flammable, plus a tinderbox. He took out his knife and notched the match in divisions, each equal to the width of his thumb. Then he said, "Fawkes, light the tinder, then say the Lord's Prayer, neither quickly nor slowly, but just as you would in church." Fawkes lit the match. "Pater Noster," he began, and said the words of the prayer in Latin. When he had finished, the match had burned almost to the first mark. Rollo blew it out. "Now," said Rollo, "how many Pater Nosters will it take you to get clean away from here?" Fawkes frowned. "To leave here, close the doors and walk to the river?" "Two Pater Nosters," he said. "To get into the boat, untie the rope and deploy the oars, two more. Another six, maybe, to row far enough to be safe from the blast. Say 10 altogether. Then you must cut the match to a length of 10 thumb widths." Fawkes nodded. Rollo stood up. "It's time to broach the gunpowder." Fawkes pulled the table over, stood on it, and started to remove bundles of firewood from the top. He passed them down to Rollo, rather than toss them on the floor, because they were needed intact to rebuild the barrier, just in case of a second search. Rollo had a strange feeling in the pit of his belly. It was really happening now, at last. They were going to kill the king. After a few minutes, they had made a passage through the stack to the barrels. Rollo had with him a crowbar and a gardening tool like a small shovel. He levered off the top of a gunpowder barrel and tipped it over, spilling the dark grey powder on the ground. With the shovel, he laid a trail of gunpowder from the barrel to the front of the stack. This would act as the fuse. He had been careful to pick a wooden shovel. An iron tool might have struck sparks from the slabs of the stone floor and blown them all up in a heartbeat. It was now terrifyingly real, and Rollo felt his whole being thrilled to the knowledge. Here was the gunpowder and the match. Above was the chamber. Tomorrow was the day. The explosion would rock the kingdom and end English Protestantism. The triumph Rollo had sought for half a century was within his grasp. In just a few hours, his life's work would be done. "We must put the firewood back carefully," he said. "The end of the gunpowder trail needs to be just under the front bundle." Together they rebuilt the stack and adjusted it until he was satisfied. Rollo said to Fawkes, "Tonight, the rest of us leave for the Shires, to be ready to start the uprising." Fawkes nodded. "Tomorrow morning, as soon as you're sure the king is in the chamber above, you simply light the match, place it on the floor with the unlit end securely embedded in the powder trail, and leave." "Yes," said Fawkes. "You'll hear the explosion from the river." "Yes," Fawkes said again. "They'll hear it in Paris." In the long gallery at Whitehall, just a few minutes' walk from Westminster Yard, there was calm, but Ned's instincts were sounding a raucous, insistent alarm. Robert Cecil thought Thomas Percy was an untrustworthy character, but he saw no harm in a stack of firewood. The Earl of Suffolk was worried about the political ructions that would result from a false accusation against the Earl of Northumberland. But Ned was sure someone intended to kill the king, and he knew that person had not yet been found. Fortunately, King James shared Ned's heightened sense of danger. He had an iron undershirt that he often wore in situations that made him feel vulnerable, and he decided he would wear it tomorrow to the opening ceremony. That was not enough for Ned, and late in the evening, he got the king to agree to a second search of the House of Lords. Those privy councillors, still worried about causing unnecessary alarm, insisted that the party be led by a Westminster Justice of the Peace, Thomas Knevett, and that he pretend to be looking for some missing ceremonial robes belonging to the king. Ned did not care what they pretended,
as long as he was part of the group. The others carried lanterns, but Ned took a blazing torch, drawing frowns of disapproval from those worried about discretion. "A search is a search," he said stubbornly. "If you can't see, you can't find anything." As they walked the short distance from the Palace of Whitehall to Westminster Yard, their lanterns casting restless shadows, Ned thought about Marjorie. She was always on his mind, even while he struggled to save the life of the king. He was terminally angry with her, but he missed her agonizingly. He hated going to a noisy tavern every evening and sleeping alone in a strange bed. He wanted to tell her things and ask her opinion. His heart ached for her. He was secretly glad to be living through a major emergency, for it occupied his mind and distracted him from his misery. The party entered the House of Lords by the main door and searched the great hall and the two adjoining rooms, the prince's chamber and the painted chamber. Unfortunately, Ned did not know what he was looking for. A concealed assassin? A hidden cannon? Nothing was found. "How will I feel," Ned wondered, "if this really is a false alarm? I will look foolish, but the king will live, and that's all that matters." At ground level were various apartments. They searched the porter's lodge and the wardrobe keeper's apartment, rented by Thomas Percy. Then they entered the storeroom, going in through the door Suffolk had broken down earlier. Ned was surprised at how large the place was, but otherwise it was as Suffolk had described it, even to the servant in cloak and hat guarding the place. "You must be Johnson," Ned said to the man. "At your service, sir." Ned frowned. There was something familiar about Johnson. "Have I met you before?" "No, sir." Ned was not so sure, but it was hard to tell in the flickering torchlight. He turned to the firewood stack. There was a lot of it. Did Thomas Percy intend to start a conflagration? It would quickly blaze up to the wooden ceiling of the storeroom, which must be the floor of the chamber of the House of Lords. But this was an unreliable method of assassination. In all likelihood, someone would smell smoke, and the royal family would be hustled out of the building in safety long before the place burned down. In order to be a serious danger, a fire would have to develop fast, with tar and turpentine, like a fireship, turning the building into an inferno before anyone could get out. Was there tar or turpentine here? Ned could not see any. He moved closer to the stack. As he did so, he heard Johnson stifle a protest. He turned and looked at the man. "Something wrong?" "Pardon me, sir, but your torch is giving off sparks. Please take care not to set light to the wood." Johnson was unnecessarily jittery. "If the wood catches fire, you can stamp it out," Ned said dismissively, and he went closer. The wood was stacked with meticulous neatness. Something deep in Ned's memory was struggling to get out. This scene reminded him of another, long in his past, but he could not bring it to mind. He felt that he had stood like this, in a dark storeroom, looking at a pile of something, once before in his life, but he could not think when or where. He turned away from the stack to see that everyone else was watching him in silence. They thought he was crazy. He did not care. He looked again at Percy's caretaker and noticed that the man was wearing spurs. "Going somewhere, Johnson?" he said. "No, sir." "Then why are you wearing spurs?" "I was on horseback earlier." Your boots seem remarkably clean for a man who has been riding in November weather." Without waiting for an answer, Ned turned back to the firewood. An old table, with a hole in its top, stood near the stack, and Ned guessed that someone had stood on the table to place the topmost bundles carefully. Suddenly, he remembered. It had been the terrible night of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in Paris. He and Sylvie had taken refuge in the warehouse in the Rue de Mur, where she kept her secret store of banned books. They had listened to the muffled sounds of riot in the city, the hoarse shouts of men fighting and the screams of those wounded, the pop of gunfire and the demented ringing of hundreds of church bells. In the warehouse, by the light of a lamp, Ned had looked at a stack of barrels that appeared to fill the space floor to ceiling and side to side. But some of the barrels could be removed to reveal boxes of contraband literature. "By the mass," Ned said softly. He handed his torch to another of the search party and clambered onto the table, careful not to put his foot through the hole.
Once standing fairly securely on the table, he reached up and removed the top bundle of faggots. He threw it to the ground, then reached for another. He heard a scuffle and turned. John Johnson was making a run for it, dashing across the storeroom to the far end. Ned shouted a warning, but one of his companions was already acting. It was Edmund Doubleday, he saw, and he was running after Johnson. Johnson reached a door in the end wall, not previously visible in the dim light, and threw it open. At that moment, Doubleday launched himself through the air. He cannoned into Johnson with an audible thud. Both men fell to the floor. Johnson tried to struggle up, and Doubleday grabbed his leg. Johnson kicked Doubleday in the face. Then the others surrounded them. As Johnson tried to get to his feet, they shoved him down again. Someone sat on him. Another man grabbed his arms, and a third sat on his legs. Johnson stopped struggling. Ned crossed the room and looked down at Johnson. His face was now clearly visible in the light of several lamps.
"I recognize you," Ned said. "You're Guy Fawkes."
"Go to hell," said Fawkes. Ned said, "Tie his hands behind his back and hobble his ankles so that he can walk but not run." Someone said, "There's no rope. Take off his breeches and tear them into strips." A man with no breeches would not get far. Something had triggered Johnson's sudden flight. "What are you scared of?" Ned asked thoughtfully. There was no reply. "It was when I threw down the second bundle of firewood," Ned thought. What was the significance of that? "Go through his pockets," he said. Doubleday knelt beside Johnson and searched him. Doubleday had a large red mark on his face from the kick, and it was already beginning to swell, but he appeared not to have noticed it yet. From inside Johnson's cloak, Doubleday produced a tinderbox and a touchwood match. So, Ned thought, he was going to set fire to something. The match was notched, as if for the purpose of timing its burning, perhaps so that the person who lit it would be able to get away before... Before what? Ned looked over at the firewood stack, then at the man who was holding his flaming torch, and a terrifying possibility occurred to him. "Take my torch outside immediately, please, and put out the flames," he said, just managing to keep his voice calm. "Right now." The man to whom he had given the torch stepped smartly outside. Ned heard the hissing sound of flames being extinguished in water, probably a nearby horse trough, and he breathed a little easier. The interior was still dimly lit by the lanterns held by the others in the search party. "Now," said Ned, "let's see if this wall of firewood conceals what I think it does." The younger men started moving the bundles. Almost immediately, Ned saw a dark grey powder on the floor. It was almost the same colour as the stones of which the floor was made. It looked like gunpowder. He shuddered to think how near to it he had stood with his flaming, sparking torch in his hand. No wonder Johnson had been nervous. Behind the bundles was a space, just as in Sylvie's warehouse. But here, it was not Bibles that were hidden, but barrels. Dozens of them. One had been tilted off its base to spill a heap of powder on the floor. Ned held up a lamp to see more, and was awestruck. There were at least 30 barrels of various sizes, more than enough gunpowder to flatten the House of Lords and kill everyone inside, including Ned Willand. He was surprised at how angry he felt at the thought that Rollo had planned to kill him, as well as the royal family and the rest of the Privy Council and most members of Parliament. He was not the only one to feel that way. Doubleday said, "They were going to murder us all." Several others voiced their agreement. One of the men standing over Fawkes kicked him in the balls, hard. Fawkes writhed in pain. Ned understood the impetus, but stopped the violence. "We need him conscious and talking," he said. "He's going to give us the names of all his collaborators." "A pity," one of the men said. "I'd like to beat him to death." "Don't worry," said Ned. "In a few hours' time he'll be stretched on the rack. He'll suffer screaming agony before he betrays his friends, and when he's done that, he'll be hung, drawn, and quartered." He stared at the man on the floor for a long moment. "That's probably punishment enough," he said. Rollo rode through the night, changing horses when he could, and reached Newcastle on the morning of Tuesday, November 5th.
There he and Earl Bartlett waited anxiously for the messenger from London, who would bring them the joyous news of the death of the king. In the chapel that was part of the castle complex were dozens of swords, guns, and armour. As soon as he heard that the king was dead, Bartlett would summon loyal Catholics and arm them, and that they would march on Kingsbridge, where Rollo would hold a Latin mass in the cathedral. If something went wrong, and the news from London was not what Rollo expected, he had an alternative plan. A fast horse was standing by, and a pair of saddlebags packed with a few essentials. He would ride to Coombe Harbour and take the first ship to France. With luck, he would escape before Ned Willard closed England's ports in his hunt for the gunpowder plotters. It was almost impossible that they would hear anything on the Tuesday. But just the same, Rollo and Bartlett stayed up late just in case. Rollo spent a restless night and got up at first light on the Wednesday. Had the world changed? Was England in the midst of a revolution? They would surely know the answers before the sun went down today. They found out earlier than that. Rollo was at breakfast with Bartlett and the family when they heard hoofbeats pounding into the compound. They all jumped up from the table, rushed through the house, and ran out of the main door, desperately eager to know what had happened. A dozen men and horses milled around the courtyard. For a moment, it was not clear who was in charge. Rollo scanned the faces, looking for someone familiar. All the men were heavily armed, some with swords and daggers, others with guns. Then Rollo saw Ned Willard. Rollo froze. What did that mean? Had the plan gone wrong? Or was it that the revolution had begun and Ned was part of a desperate rearguard action by the tattered remains of the Protestant government? Ned gave the answer immediately. "I found your gunpowder," he said. The words hit Rollo like bullets. He felt shot in the heart. The plot had failed. Rage boiled up in him as he thought how Ned had frustrated him again and again through the years. He wanted more than anything else to get his hands around Ned's throat and squeeze the life out of him. He tried to suppress his emotions and think straight. So Ned had found the gunpowder, but how had he known that Rollo had put it there? Rollo said, "Did my sister betray me?" "She kept your secret 30 years longer than she should have." Betrayed by a woman. He should never have trusted her. He thought of the waiting horse. Did he have a slim chance of escaping from this crowd of strong young men, reaching the stable and riding away? Ned seemed to read his mind. He pointed at Rollo and said, "Watch him carefully. He's been slipping through my hands for 30 years. One of the men lifted a long-barreled arquebus and aimed it at Rollo's nose. It was an old gun with a matchlock mechanism, and he could see the glowing match, ready to be touched to the firing pan. At that point, Rollo knew it was all over. Earl Bartlett began a blustering protest, but Rollo felt impatient for the end. He was 70 years old, and he had nothing more to live for. He had spent his life trying to destroy England's heretical monarchy, and he had failed. He would not get another chance. Sheriff Mathewson, grandson of the sheriff Rollo remembered from his youth, spoke to Bartlett in a firm but calm voice. "Let's have no trouble, please, my lord," he said. "It won't do anyone any good." The sheriff's reasonable tones and Bartlett's ranting both seemed to Rollo like background noise. Feeling as if he were in a dream, or perhaps a play, he reached inside his doublet and drew his dagger. The deputy holding a gun on him said in a panicky voice, "Drop that knife!" The arquebus shook in his hands, but he managed to keep it pointing at Rollo's face. Silence fell, and everyone looked at Rollo. "I'm going to kill you," Rollo said to the deputy. He had no intention of doing anything of the kind, but he raised the knife high, careful not to move his head and spoil the deputy's aim. "Prepare to die," he said. Behind the deputy, Ned moved. The deputy pulled the trigger, and the lighted cord touched the gunpowder in the firing tray. Rollo saw a flash and heard a bang, and knew instantly that he had been cheated of an easy death. At the last split second, the barrel had been knocked aside by Ned. Rollo felt a sharp pain at the side of his head and sensed blood on his ear, and understood that the ball had grazed him. Ned grabbed his arm and took away the knife. "I'm not finished with you," he said.
Marjorie was summoned to see the king. It would not be the first time she had met him. In the 2 years of his reign so far, she had attended several royal festivities with Ned, banquets and pageants and plays. Ned regarded James as a voluptuary, interested mainly in sensual pleasure, but Marjorie thought he had a cruel streak. Her brother, Rollo, must have confessed everything under torture, and therefore he would have implicated her in the smuggling of priests into England. She would be accused and arrested and executed alongside him, she supposed. She thought of Mary Stuart, a brave Catholic martyr. Marjorie wanted to die with dignity, as Queen Mary had, but Mary was a queen and had been mercifully beheaded. Female traitors were burned at the stake. Would Marjorie be able to retain her dignity and pray for her tormentors as she died? Or would she scream and cry, curse the Pope, and beg for mercy? She did not know. Worse for her was the prospect that Bartlett and Roger would suffer the same fate. She put on her best clothes and went to Whitehall. Ned was waiting for her in the anteroom, to her surprise. "We're going in together," he said. "Why?" "You'll see." He was tense, wound up tight, and she could not tell whether he was still angry with her. She said, "Am I to be executed?" "I don't know." Marjorie felt dizzy and feared she was going to fall. Ned saw her stagger and grabbed her. For a moment, she slumped in his arms, too relieved to hold herself upright. Then she pushed herself away. She had no right to his embrace. "I'll be all right," she said. He held her arm a little longer, then released her, and she was able to support herself. But he still looked at her with an angry frown. What did it mean? She did not have long to puzzle over this before a royal servant nodded to Ned to indicate that they should go in. They entered the long gallery side by side. Marjorie had heard that King James liked to have meetings in this room because he could look at the pictures when he got bored. Ned bowed, and Marjorie curtsied, and James said, "The man who saved my life." When he spoke, he drooled a little, a mild impediment that seemed to go with his sybaritic tastes. "Your Majesty is very kind," Ned said, "and of course you know Lady Marjorie, the Dowager Countess of Shiring and my wife of 15 years. James nodded but did not say anything, and Marjorie deduced from his coolness that he knew of her religious affiliation. Ned said, "I want to ask your Majesty a favour." James said, "I'm tempted to see, even unto the half of my kingdom, except that the frieze has an unlucky history." He was referring to the story of Salome, who had asked for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. "I don't think I've ever asked your Majesty for anything, although perhaps my service might have won me your goodwill. You saved me from those evil gunpowder devils, me and my family and the entire Parliament," said James. "Come on, out with it. What do you want?" During the interrogation of Rollo Fitzgerald, he made certain accusations about crimes committed many years ago, during the 1570s and 1580s, in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. "What sort of claims are we talking about?" "He confessed to smuggling Catholic priests into England." "He's going to hang anyway. He claims he had collaborators." "And who were they?" "The late Earl of Shiring, Bart, his then-wife Marjorie, who is now my wife, and their two sons, Bartlett, who is now the Earl, and Lord Roger." The king's face darkened. "A serious charge. I ask your Majesty to consider that a woman may be dominated by a strong-willed husband and an equally overpowering brother, and that she and her children are not entirely to blame for crimes committed under such strong masculine influence." Marjorie knew this was not true. She had been the leader, not the follower. She might have said so if her own life had been the only one at stake, but she bit her tongue. Ned said, "I ask your Majesty to spare their lives. It is the only reward I ask for saving your own." "I can't see that this request pleases me," the king said. Ned said nothing. "But the smuggling of priests took place a long time ago, you see. It ended after the Spanish Armada. From then on, Rollo Fitzgerald did not involve his family in his crimes. I would not even consider this, were it not for the remarkable service you have rendered the crown of England over so many years." "My whole life, your Majesty." The king looked grumpy,
but at last he nodded. Very well. There will be no prosecutions of his collaborators.
Thank you.
Yamigo. Ned bowed. Marjorie curtsied, and they left. They walked together, without speaking, through the series of anterooms and out of the palace into the street. There they both turned east. They went past the Church of St. Martin in the Fields and along the Strand. Marjorie felt nothing but relief. All the lying and double-dealing was over. They passed the palaces along the Thames shore and entered the less affluent Fleet Street. Marjorie did not know what was going on in Ned's mind, but he seemed to be coming home with her. Or was that too much to hope for? They entered the city through Ludgate and started up the rise. Ahead of them, on top of the hill, St. Paul's Cathedral towered over rows of low thatched houses like a lioness with cubs. Still, Ned had not spoken, but Marjorie sensed that his mood had changed. His face slowly relaxed. The lines of tension and anger seemed to dissolve, and there was even a hint of his old wry smile. Emboldened, Marjorie reached out and took his hand in her own. For a long moment, he let her hold his hand without responding, and it lay limp in her grasp. Then, at last, she felt him squeeze her fingers, gently but firmly, and she knew it was going to be all right. We hanged him in front of Kingsbridge Cathedral. Marjorie and I did not want to join the crowd, but we could not be absent either, so we watched from the window of the old house. She burst into tears when they brought Rollo from the Guildhall down the main street to the market square and walked him up the scaffold. When the support was jerked from beneath him, Marjorie began to pray for his soul. As a Protestant, I never believed in prayers for dead souls, but I joined in for her sake. And I had done something more practical, also for her sake. Rollo should have been cut down and disemboweled while still alive, then hacked into pieces, but I had bribed the executioner, and so Rollo was allowed to choke to death before his body was ritually mutilated, to the disappointment of the crowd, who had wanted to see the traitor suffer. After that, I retired from court life. Marjorie and I came back to Kingsbridge permanently. Roger, who never found out that he was my son, took over from me as the Member of Parliament for Kingsbridge. My nephew, Alfo, became the richest man in Kingsbridge. I remained Lord of Wigley. I had developed a strong affection for the people of my little village. So Rollo was the last of the men I sent to the gallows. But there is one more part of the story to be told. Epilogue. 1620. At the age of 80, Ned spent a lot of time sleeping. He napped in the afternoon, he went to bed early, and he sometimes nodded off after breakfast in the front parlour of the Kingsbridge house. The house was always full. Barney's son, Alfo, and Ned's son, Roger, both had children and grandchildren. Roger had bought the house next door, and the youngsters treated the two houses as one home. Someone had told them that Grandpa Ned knew everything, and his great-grandchildren often came running into the parlour with questions. He was endlessly intrigued by what they asked him. How long does it take to get to Egypt? Did Jesus have a sister? What's the biggest number? He watched them with intense pleasure, fascinated by the random nature of family resemblances. One had Barney's roguish charm, another Alice's relentless determination, and one little girl brought tears to his eyes when she smiled just like Marjorie. Inherited traits showed themselves in other ways, too. Alfo was mayor of Kingsbridge, as his grandfather Edmund had been. Roger was a member of King James's Privy Council. Over at Newcastle, Earl Swifty was, sadly, as much of a swaggering bully as Swithin, Bart, and Bartlett had been. The family had grown like a spreading tree, and Ned and Marjorie had watched its progress together until her life had come to a peaceful end 3 years ago. Ned still talked to her sometimes when he was alone. "Alfo has bought the Slaughterhouse Tavern," he would say as he got into bed at the end of the day. Or again, "Little Eddie is as tall as me now." It hardly mattered that she made no reply. He knew what she would have thought. "Money sticks to Alfo like honey on his fingers," she would have said, and
Eddie will be after girls any day now. Ned had not been to London for years and would never go again. Strangely enough, he did not pine for the excitement of tracking down spies and traitors, nor for the challenges and intrigues of government. It was the theatre he missed. He had loved plays ever since he saw the story of Mary Magdalene performed at Newcastle on that 12th day of Christmas, so long ago. But a play was a rare event in Kingsbridge. Travelling companies came only once or twice a year to perform in the yard of the Bell Inn. Ned's consolation was that he had some of his favourite plays in book form, so he could read them. There was one writer he particularly enjoyed, though he could never remember the fellow's name. He forgot a lot of things these days. He had a book on his lap now, and he had fallen asleep over it. Wondering what had awakened him, he looked up to see a young man with Marjorie's curly, dark hair. His grandson, Jack, the son of Roger. He smiled. Jack was like Marjorie in other ways, good-looking and charming and feisty, and far too earnest about religion. His extremism had gone in the direction opposite to Marjorie's, and he was some kind of Puritan. This caused bad-tempered rows with his pragmatic father. Jack was 27 and single. To the surprise of his family, he had chosen to be a builder and had prospered. There were famous builders in the family's past. Heritage again, perhaps. Now he sat in front of Ned and said, "I have some important news, Grandfather. I'm going away." "Why? You have a successful business here in Kingsbridge. The king makes life uncomfortable for those of us who take the teachings of the Bible seriously." What he meant was that he and his Puritan friends stubbornly disagreed with the English Church on numerous points of doctrine, and King James was as intolerant of them as he was of Catholics. "I'd be very sorry to see you go, Jack," Ned said. "You remind me of your grandmother. I'll be sorry to say goodbye, but we want to live in a place where we can do God's will without interference. I spent my life trying to make England that kind of country. But it's not, is it? It's more tolerant than any other place, as far as I know. Where would you go in search of greater freedom?"
"The New World."
"God's body!" Ned was rocked. "I didn't think you were going that far. Sorry about the bad language. You startled me." Jack nodded acknowledgement of the apology. He disapproved almost as much as the Catholics of the blasphemous exclamations Ned had learned from Queen Elizabeth. But he said no more about it. "A group of us have decided to sail to the New World and start a colony there."
"What an adventure!"
"It's the kind of thing your grandmother Marjorie would have loved to do." Ned felt envious of Jack's youth and boldness. Ned himself would never travel again. Luckily, he had rich memories of Calais, of Paris, of Amsterdam. He recalled every detail of those journeys, even when he could not remember what day of the week it was. Jack was saying, "Although James will continue to be our king theoretically, we hope he will take less interest in how we choose to worship, since it will be impossible for him to enforce his rules at such a distance."
"I dare say you're right. I wish you well. Pray for us, please."
"I will. Tell me the name of your ship so that I can ask God to watch over it."
"It's called the Mayflower."
"The Mayflower. I must try to remember that." Jack went to the writing table.
"I'll note it down for you. I want us to be in your prayers."
"Thank you."
It was oddly touching that Jack cared so much about Ned's prayers. Jack wrote on a scrap of paper and put down the pen.
"I must leave you now. I've got so much to do."
"Of course. I'm feeling tired anyway. I may take a little nap."
"Sleep well, Grandfather."
"God be with you, beloved boy."
Jack left, and Ned looked out of the window at the glorious west front of the cathedral. From here he could just see the entrance to the graveyard, where both Sylvie and Marjorie lay. He did not look down at his book. He was happy with his thoughts. There were often enough for him nowadays. His mind was like a house he had spent his life furnishing. Its tables and beds were the songs he could sing, the plays he had watched, the cathedrals he had seen, and the books he had read in English, French, and Latin. He shared this notional house with his family, alive and dead, his parents, his brother, the women he had loved, the children.
There were guest rooms for important visitors such as Francis Walsingham, William and Robert Cecil, Francis Drake, and, of course, Queen Elizabeth. His enemies were there too, Rollo Fitzgerald, Pierre-Aumont de Guise, Guy Fawkes, although they were locked in the cellar, for they could do him no more harm. The pictures on the walls were of the times when he had been brave, or clever, or kind. They made the house a happy place, and the bad things he had done, the lies he had told, and the people he had betrayed, and the times he had been cowardly, were scrawled in ugly letters on the wall of the outhouse. His memory formed the library of the house. He could pick out any volume and instantly be transported to another place and time. Kingsbridge Grammar School in his innocent childhood, Hatfield Palace in the thrilling year of 1558, the banks of the Seine River on the bloodstained night of St. Bartholomew, the Channel during the battle with the Spanish Armada. Strangely, the character of Ned that lived in those stories did not remain the same. It seemed to him sometimes that quite a different person had learned Latin. Someone else had fallen under the spell of young Princess Elizabeth. Another character had stabbed a man with no nose in the graveyard of the church of Saint-Julien-le-Pauvre. And yet another had watched the fireships scatter the galleons off Calais. But of course, they were all just different versions of himself, the owner of the house. And one day soon, the place would fall down, as old buildings did, and then, quite quickly, it would all turn to dust. With that thought, he drifted off to sleep. Who is real? Readers sometimes ask me which of the characters in a novel are real historical figures and which are fictional. For those who are curious about this, here's a list of the real people in A Column of Fire. England. Mary Tudor, Queen of England. Elizabeth Tudor, her half-sister, later Queen. Tom Parry, Elizabeth's treasurer. Sir William Cecil, advisor to Elizabeth. Robert Cecil, William's son. Sir Francis Walsingham, spymaster. Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. Sir Nicholas Throckmorton. Nicholas Heath, Lord Chancellor. Sir Francis Drake, sea captain. Sir John Hawkins, naval commander, said to also be a pirate. Sir Francis Throckmorton. George Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury. Bess of Hardwick. Sir Amias Paulet. Gilbert Gifford, spy. William Davison, temporary secretary of state to Queen Elizabeth. Anthony Babington, traitor. Margaret Clitheroe, Catholic martyr. Howard of Effingham, Lord High Admiral. Philip Herbert, Earl of Pembroke, Earl of Montgomery. Edmund Doubleday. Guy Fawkes. Thomas Percy. France. François, Duke of Guise. Henri, son of François. Charles, Cardinal of Lorraine, brother of François. Marie de Guise, sister of François and mother of Mary, Queen of Scots. Louis Bottles, Cardinal de Guise. Anna d'Este, Duchess of Guise. Henri II, King of France. Caterina de Medici, Queen of France. Diane de Poitiers, mistress of King Henri II. Children of Henri and Caterina. Francis II, King of France. Charles IX, King of France. Henri III, King of France. Margot, Queen of Navarre. Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots. Antoine, King of Navarre. Henri, son of Antoine, later King Henri IV of France. Louis, Prince of Condé. Gaspard de Coligny, Admiral of France. Charles de Louvier, assassin. William Allen, leader of the exiled English Catholics. Ambroise Paré, royal surgeon. Jean de Poltrot, assassin. Jean de Hengest. Jean Le Charon, provost of Paris. Scotland. James Stuart, illegitimate half-brother of Mary, Queen of Scots. James Stuart, son of Mary, Queen of Scots, later King James VI of Scotland and King James I of England. Anne of Denmark, Queen of Scotland. John Leslie, Bishop of Ross. Sir William Douglas. Lady Agnes, his wife.
George Pretty Geordie, their son, Willie Douglas, Sir William's illegitimate son. Spain. King Felipe II, Count of Feria, diplomat, Bishop Alvaro de la Cuadra, Bernardino de Mendoza, ambassador to London, Alonso Pérez de Guzmán, 7th Duke of Medina Sidonia, Admiral of the Spanish Armada. Netherlands. Margarita of Parma, governor, illegitimate half-sister of King Felipe II, Peter Tietelmans, Grand Inquisitor. This is John Lee. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Column of Fire by Ken Follett. This program was directed by Christina Rooney, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2017 by Ken Follett. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.